Thanks, everyone, for being here and for bearing witness to the circus that we are. We do have rules. I swear we don't just let our children run into the ground, but when you have a two-year-old is really terrible and horrible, and when they turn three, they turn into a monster. And that is where Reason goes to die. So apparently that is what happened today. That was a really lovely introduction that makes me sound like a big deal, but I'm going to tell you something. This is a very humbling business. This book right here is proof, because I actually ran out of copies of my own book, so I had to order. I ordered a used one from Amazon because it was cheaper than ordering more copies from my press, because you have to buy your own book when you run out. So I found this cheap one on Amazon, a used one. It came in the mail, and I was ordering it so that I could sign it and send it to someone who wanted a copy. And I opened it to sign it, and I had already signed it to someone I actually know, who then sold it for $3 on Amazon. So, I'm going to read from this for the rest of my life, because it'll bring me down a notch for all time. Okay, so I'm going to read you a couple poems from this book, Mercies vs. the Bone, which I think some of you have been reading in your classes, which means a lot to me. And then I'm going to read more from the forthcoming manuscript, which is what has become a coloring book, but I think I can still read most of the poems. Okay, so my theme, as I'm going to work through Mercies vs. the Bone, is I'm going to read some of the persona poems. And a persona poem is just a poem in which the speaker of the poem is someone, usually named someone specific, who is not the poet, him or herself. And I'll tell you who these personas are as I'm going through. So the first one I'll read is called Portrait of a Laryngologist. And the speaker in this poem is a laryngologist. I don't even know if that exists anymore, but I got this idea from an article I read a couple years back about a doctor in the early 20th century whose work was to extract things that people had swallowed and that had become lodged in their throats. That sounds weird enough. But then he would save things that he extracted from people's throats, and it became this kind of weird collection that he had. And some of the things that were named in the article, some of the things he'd extracted were really strange. And I just kind of took it and ran with it. So this is Portrait of a Laryngologist in the voice of this throat doctor. Call it an excavation site, the human throat. Call it proof of our flawed anatomy, the many buttons, pendants, clothespins, and nails I've removed from one throbbing esophagus or another, the roadblocked windpipes. The history of swallowed objects is a tragic collection. Each x-ray tells the same story, the bright negative of ribs ebbing away from the darkened sternum, the various centerpieces, a pencil lodged perfectly vertically, sharpened, an open safety pin, a quarter suspended as if in midair, Washington in profile, 1979 in faintly raised relief, the reeded edge thumbed smooth. Call it an accident, but it never is. It's a kind of intimacy to swallow the odds and ends of your beloved, I tell people, like sex, like the woman who, in her grief, swallowed the bullet that had killed her husband, or the man who came to me unable to speak for the agony of his wife's car key. To keep her from leaving, he confessed, when I pulled it free, the metonymic object lying on the table between us. How it shone with pink traces of his blood, broken tissue caught in the serrated edges. This next one is called Cain Walking Away, and it's in the voice of Cain in the book of Genesis, in the moment following the murder of his brother Abel. Sudden fevers of color and blotch vex the corners of my eyes. Vermilion, cobalt, eclipse of white. Something in the verdure there, mocking thrash, a pawing at loose earth. Loose, loosening, as the hours, as my knees crumbling forward, my palms thrust in soil, root cooled. I offer blood instead, spilled for a favor I craved. How does one separate love from the other fervors? My sin is to feel too much. The horizon begins to reap the remaining light, darkness growing like a scar. My heart is a handful of seeds in their dark, inevitable ripening. Feel fields of fruit beneath the same light and wind, fixed, origined, like brothers. What brother? This poem is called Housewife. Says the wife to the house, "We are not together. You have no heart at all, no percussive blunder to ruin you. Your rooms are cool and languid, your doors open and close, even the knives are stacked like kindling. You give back everything you take. The cacti peer from their clay pots like waterless periscopes. Nothing in me is where it belongs." A few years ago, when we were visiting Madison, Wisconsin, they had an exhibit in the museum there about the Houdinis, Harry and his wife Bess. And I knew a little about Harry Houdini, but I was more interested in what I learned about Bess from the exhibit, which was that she was originally a part of his act, and as he became extremely famous, she was sort of dropped and he had professional assistants. Nonetheless, she was almost always in the crowd, always watching him. So this is from her point of view. Watching him jump from Harvard Bridge in chains and get himself out of the chains once he's under the Charles River. It's called Bess. "Each time he jumps from Harvard Bridge, I expect the fall to last the eternity of a Tuesday afternoon. His body not in plummet, but in orbit, celestial, something I interpret for rain, for seasons. Nights he lets me see his wrists, burnished and welted red from the chains. We never speak of the hurt. Instead, I think of the time, hung by his ankles above Times Square, he hatched himself from a straitjacket. How I expected wet wings instead of arms. The place closest to pain shines. And now the poised musculature of his thighs unstitches the water. You are an aperture, I want to tell him. Though of what, I am not sure. Fear? In furtive agony, he nears the other world. And now he surfaces, chainless, to applause and a thicket of gasps, this world eager as usual to peer into such a vanishing. He glistens on the bank of the Charles, preening himself dry with a towel. And a tender wreath of blisters blooms around his. So the last poem I'll read from this book, I think has to be Postcards, which was the first poem I ever had accepted, which was accepted by the Southern Indiana Review. And I can't remember if this is the exact version or if I revised it for the book, but nonetheless, it's close enough. So this is a throwback to 2009, I think, when this was accepted. And as Mark said, just pretty much made my life. Postcards. The postcard you mailed from England arrived today, tea-stained, like the one you found bookmarked in 20 love poems and a song of despair at a used bookstore, the woman's cursive so delicate that you kept the card and forgot the book. Out of her solitude, my mother named me a harbor, safe place, haven for the deep-tossed ship that strides an ocean in a month, propelled by the whim of the winds and the tide of the stars, to the dark pool of unchange, to the untouched sands where it buries its anchor. A bell and a sigh, you called me, speaking my name aloud into desire. The only two syllables spoken, they hovered over us, then settled with the moonlight across your shoulders, my fingers picketed along your back. It is this name on the postcard, the name my mother gave me, and with each letter you have scrawled a new language, a series of lilts and curves pressing urgently against the next, unmistakably mine, suddenly yours. Okay, so I'll read a few poems from the forthcoming book, which is called The Spinning Place. And I'm aware we're running out of time, and listening to too much poetry can be pretty terrible. So I'll pick and choose here. But the poem I'll start with, actually, Mark sort of referenced in his introduction, which is that when my first book came out and I went on sort of a mini book tour in Florida, which is where my press was based, it was while I was on the book tour that I realized I was pregnant with Eloise, so I had to keep the secret until I came home because I wanted to tell Mark in person. But what happened was on the flight back, I don't know if I was anxious or nervous or what, actually passed out in the aisle of the flight, and they had to drag me to the back of the plane and almost emergency landed, and it was this whole thing. So anyway, rethinking that experience, I decided to cast it as a kind of annunciation in which I am both the pregnant woman and the angel descending with the news of the pregnancy, thinking of the plane as a kind of descent. So this is called Annunciation. While pregnant, I developed aviophobia. It wasn't when the test read yes, or when the blood didn't come, or when my breasts became so tender I shrank even from the shower's hot-fingered caress. No, I first became convinced of our two helical strands spiraling and knotting inside me beyond my ability to count or stop them, only when, as the plane nosed west somewhere over Georgia, my skin paled, lit with a cold, fevered sheen of panic, made of me a trembling hallucination. All sound reached me as through a blue whelm of sea, a high, keening whale call. Alone among strangers, my body glyphed with secret and threatening to tell, I slipped from consciousness into the stewardess's firm grip on my elbow, the oxygen mask she cupped over my face, her water words calling, "Is there a doctor on board?" I fell and fell from that sky, unearthly, impossibly winged, to find you in the airport, my oracle's lips lusterless. But I brought you no prophecy at all, only a kind of proof of what had already happened. My clothes still cloud-dewed with sweat, my hair tendrilled damply to my neck with the labor of what it took to descend with this news. The Annunciation for me is a moment in the Gospel of Luke that sort of remains a source of fascination. So this is another poem that imagines this, or thinks about the Annunciation. Probably the only thing you need to know about this poem is that it references Vanek's painting of the Annunciation, and you probably don't have that poised perfectly in your mind right now. But the thing I love about the painting is that the dove, as it's descending toward Mary, is basically making a beeline toward her head with its beak pointed at her like it's violent, like it's about to rip open the top of her head. So this sort of references that. Descent, sort of an annunciation. At the tree's tip, the hawk folds his massive dust-colored wings and casts his yellow eyes like a line upon the fields, crisp and blue in the season's first frost. He is not a dove, though when he descends, it will be with the velocity of Vanek's dove toward Mary's crown. The cars on this highway do not slow to look. The world is always moving, and nearly everything in it. There was morning and there was evening, the story goes, and the animals and the man's tongue and his strange mouth naming them. The first work is to speak. Why then, when I saw you in your shadow clouds on the screen, webbed and frog-like, your one heart a nucleus of trembling, why could I not? Perhaps that is what the hawk's eye roves for, how it knows what unstill thing to pursue. I was afraid, afraid of our oneness, my ability to save you from nothing. And finding the quickening in the smallest grass blade shadow, it dives, a descent upon which everything depends, morning and evening, and the name of the creature in the crosshairs of that yellow eye, now terrified into the rest of its life. Okay. This next poem is called My Sister Sketches Her Anorexia. The nude girl on the page looks away, knees sharp as the corners of rooms, ribs a legible alphabet of bone. But the drawn girl does not know what it is to refuse to eat. She was born this way from my sister's cold pencil. Suppose this is how we arrived here, already advanced in our renunciations, already granted the ruins of ourselves. Imagine the nurse in her blood-smattered blues, weeping a little to lay the starving baby on the scale. Would we be happy then? Sainted errata, wounds anticipating wounds. The mother would stretch out her arms with umbilical love to hold the crying anatomy of air who in a few years will sketch her hungered self. Now see the drawn girl twist to look at her own delible edges. See her scratch at them with her thumbnails. How she works to erase herself. Okay. I think I'll just read two more from this book, from this coloring book manuscript. Okay. This poem is called Exile, the Spellbound Horses. In a field, a house. Asleep in the house, a girl dreams, but this is not the dream. From the barn behind the house, nervous whinnying, the safe smell of shit and hay. Blue lupine rims the whole field, bends in a crescendo of wind, then another and another. A dark cone twists from the low clouds, arrows earthward, spins toward the whinnying. In the dream, the girl is speaking, but her words collapse into garbled sounds, and someone she loves steps farther away until he can no longer hear her. The horses are silent now, black as pupils, a mime of fright, even as the dark cone shreds the roof of their barn, the partition between their stalls. Now the walls, too, are hoisted and heaved into jagged planks about the yard, and the hay whirls into a seething cloud of whips to send them from this place. Afterward, in the calm and ruined wake, the horses are free. They can cross together the field's lupine edge, alone as gods, free as exiles. And the sleeping girl, when will she know their sorrow? When she wakes, she will find the end of the world is the shape of the absence of two horses, switching their tails beyond what she can see. In the ravaged yard, her feet will be bare, her hair uncombed, and the sugar will slip through her fingers. So I'll just read one more poem. I'll read the last poem from this manuscript. Before I do, I just want to echo Mark and say thank you so much for hosting us. To all of you for coming here, to the many of you who invited us to your classes. Casey, thank you so much for your hospitality. My children have bled and spit up in the office of Southern Indiana Review, so I can't say we've left it better than we found it or that we will ever be invited back here. But nonetheless, we are very grateful and have been received so warmly. This is called The Spinning Place. And this book has three title poems, and in each of them, The Spinning Place is something different. So in this poem, The Spinning Place is the propeller of a boat. They billow up from warm estuarial waters, blooming toward that brilliant, ever-shattering pain. So many manatees, the ones that are left, already bear the marks of this collision, the touching of one world to another, water to sky, vault to vault. The elephantine flesh of their backs is slashed and hatched, indelible history of what it takes to breathe. They billow up toward shifting islands of shade. Boats hover on the face of the deep, indistinguishable from cloud shadow. There, carving water from water, propellers spin and do not flinch from flesh. But the manatee's need can be met only where two worlds meet, at the bright seam that holds them together and apart. So gored, bleeding, they descend again, lungs full, with breath enough in their wounds.